Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and poem experiencer, Mikala Ann. Today we are welcoming Brian Wilkins onto the podcast. Brian is a magician, poet, and Tajiquan teacher in the Hudson Valley, and I was very blessed to get some time with him, wherein we chat about his recent poetry book, The Wheel of the Small Gods, published through Revelar Press with art by Brennan Reese. This episode is full of praxis wisdom. How do we take our rituals and turn them into art? In what ways does inviting the spirits of the Deccans into our lives change the way we process pain and disease in the body? How does healing in the body affect emotional healing in the heart and mind? Where does the concept of time fit into all this anyway? All these answers, plus some laughs and a poetry reading by Brian himself in today's episode of Saturn Vox. To find more on Saturn Vox, check out their Instagram and Twitter at Saturn Vox, or visit their website www.saturnvox.com. If you want to support the show towards goals of better equipment, merch, and bonus material, please check out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox, where one can join in our book club and Discord communities.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Wilkins. I'm a poet, a magician, a Tai Chi teacher, a fortune teller. And what I'm seeking most in all of those different things is to try to work on creating a kind of magic that's connected back to a kind of modern interpretation of healing and cunning magic. And while with Dr. Al, I choose not to use cunning person as a title all the time, unless other people use it about me. I will say that that is what I'm attempting to do, to work inside a kind of magic that explores the world around us naturally and works for each other's community benefit and healing.
Oh, love that. I adore that. So you just released a book through Revelar Press called A Wheel of the Small Gods. It was a poetry book. It was a book about medicine. It came with an accompanied oracle deck. And I guess that's what we're going to be talking about on this episode. And I do hope that people will be interested in going out and purchasing the book. So, for me, I thought that the introduction and like all the things that came before the poems was so beautiful and informative to engage with the poems, which of course could be read on their own or separately, but you spent a lot of time talking about the connection between art and alchemy, and I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a discussion on that here.
Yeah, for sure. Like every good poet, I start my book of poems with a 30-page introduction in prose. That's the history major coming out in me. So I should clarify a little bit in that I think alchemy in this sense works as a good metaphor, or we're taking the images from that tradition to sort of discuss how art can work. I'm not making a claim to have produced a philosopher's stone anytime recently, or a universal medicine, which I would be even more interested in. But I think that there is something important in addressing the idea of how component parts can be moved together to create something that is unexpected, something surprising or even magical in its production. So in the case of the poems, what I'm actually attempting to do is it's engaging with the 36 spirits of the Egyptian Deccan. And the question I was left with was, after beginning to work with them, was if I'm writing poems to them or about them or for them, like, how does this actually work in terms of bringing something to people? And what I came to understand is that much like in some understandings of alchemy, you are blending things together to refine a place for the spirit to reside. The poems themselves also are an attempt to create a container or a place in which the spirit can reside, rather than, say, a invocation or a binding of these spirits.
Okay, so it's like the poem is a spirit house.
I'm literally just making little fairy houses in the backyard with the poems. Yeah, that's the
The
idea. Yeah.
And so in that way, you were bringing up a lot about the intersection between art and ecstasy as a form of alchemic transformation.
Right.
So could you touch on that a little bit as well?
Definitely. So one of the poets that I sort of follow in doing this, because there's the magical side of it, but then there's also the sort of technicality of writing poems that are meant to do a little bit more, is the poet H.D., who is probably best known as one of the founding imagists, but wrote poetry that expanded way beyond that concept. And in particular, the idea that poetry isn't meant to be a report on what happens, or isn't meant to create a situation where you hear about the poet's experience, but rather transmit a resonance to you that you will experience the thing. It's a portal or a gateway. Because of that, you literally must experience ecstasy to be carried out of the body in order to receive the medicine, right? Like, you have to get the poem, you must move into the third space the poem creates. It must be something that makes you dance. It must be something that makes you come to life in order for it to be valuable. If it is too thin or not powerful for you in that way, then it's not worth your time. I think there's a perfectly good place for political poetry. I think there's a perfectly good place for confessional poetry. But I think we have lost a mode of healing magical poetry that comes from this desire to throw yourself into spirit and to encounter that space and to understand that we are always creating these containers. We're always, our bodies are these things too. So the poem should not only engage what we could think of as sort of a dream response or a realm response of the imagination, but it should also be, or perhaps I should better say, it wants to get you to the realm of the imagination. It's doing that through engaging your mind and your body and this total connection of events that brings you to the point where you're absolutely humming with the energy you need to understand the space.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's beautiful. Do you think that comes from this sensation of kind of transcending language, like by trying to write things in prose or write things confessionally where it's just very easy to digest with the logical mind, that somehow that blocks our ability to transcend into like the secret third thing?
it's an interesting question. So one of the great gifts I was given in this process, I did this over 3 years. The first year was the binding ritual. The second was the writing of the poems. The third year was the editing. And then after that, and those were all done in the timing of the Deccan spirits, exactly. In the third year, I was given a great gift by my magical partner, Jess Waters, an amazing poet in her own right, where she read the poems back to me. That was how she edited them for me, was just read the draft I had. And in that moment, you could begin to hear what wasn't working. And it was almost never like a moment of confusion or a moment of logical difficulty. It was almost always the sound was wrong. You know, that something here wasn't combined physically to bring out the nature that you needed. And the question of like, what do we do with meaning is interesting, because I do think the images have to convey something that people can understand. I'm not particularly a fan of, say, some of the language poetry where it breaks down just into language and just into sound. I enjoy stuff more along the sort of surrealist line as well, of like where dream and image are combined, where life, it becomes this super reality, right? So I think that taking apart the time sense of a sentence, for example, is a really good example of what you're talking about, where in a normal sentence, you expect it to run from beginning to end. I'm going to have a verb, I'm going to have a conclusion. But in a poem, you can suspend all these different grammatical and syntactical moments with spacing, with rhythm, with just where they land on the page, and allow for just enough confusion in to experience them simultaneously. And I think that getting into simultaneity is one particular poetic trick that's really important. There are others, but I think good storytelling and good prose probably can get you into this space. I don't think it's just the purview of poetry, but I think it's easier with poetry.
So it's almost like, because the whole piece of art in and of itself needs to draw from multiple different dimensions, like we're talking about sound, space, the words themselves, the feeling invoked by the combination of all of those things. And so this is not to say that a piece of literature could not do all those things, but that usually that's not the intention of a piece of literature.
Right. And we get back to that moment of like, what is this for? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, when I was, sounds like a weird tangent, but it's getting to where I want to go. I had a high school trip to Paris when I was like 17. And like most dumb Americans wandering around Paris at that age, like I didn't really have any idea of what I was doing or where I was going. And I wandered in to Sacré-Cœur Cathedral in this moment where there was a service going on. It was a bunch of nuns singing. And all of a sudden, it was sunset, right? Like it was an evening service. So there's just the feeling of walking into Paris, walking into that space, having candlelight come through and light up the space. The nuns are singing all of a sudden. The open space on the inside is doing its own resonating with my own breathing, my own tired feet, my own presence in that space. And I was immediately transported into some kind of trance, dream, vision, you know, that never left all those things. They were always there, but another element became apparent to me. And it was an incredibly psychedelic and moving moment. You could also even think of it as like a sort of moment of grace, right? That's sort of just being provided. And I think that's what a good poem should do. It should, and so when you're talking about all these other elements you have to build in, I think that's why. I think you need to overwhelm a little bit, and there needs to be maybe a little more than you can keep track of. And it has to be building these feelings and resonances inside you. As well. I mean, and the thing is, I don't know totally what's going to resonate for the reader. Mm-hmm. I don't know what a great blue heron image is going to do to you in the same way that it does to me. But I can understand that from my understanding of how to get in touch with this particular spirit and my understanding of how that temple is built, a great blue heron was necessary, right? Mm-hmm. And the feeling of seeing a great blue heron isn't just in the imagination if it's done, or it's not divorced from the body, I should say, if it's done right. You know, if I asked you to sit and think for a second about seeing a great blue heron, there are emotions and feelings that will come up for you. And that has to be present in the poem. The reality of the spirit of the great blue heron has to be there, and has to negotiate with all the other elements of the temple in order to get the effect.
Oh, wow. Oh, I love that. And, you know, it brings up another question that I wanted to touch on, which is, so the book itself and the intention of the poems, it seems to be not just to invoke the small gods of the Deccans, but to heal. You spend a lot of time talking about bodily healing through work with these spirits. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, did that come naturally? Like, I know in the book you talk about when a spirit informed you that they could do that.
Yeah.
But as you worked through it over 3 years, do you have like a deeper understanding of the way that a matter, my material body, my physical body, plays a role in my ecstatic spiritual experience?
It's a really good question. So for me, and I think also true from the viewpoint of the spirits I was engaging with and the time period, sort of, you know, we can call it Hellenistic Egypt, that, you know, that time period's coming from, there isn't this hard division between the spirit body, the energy body, and the physical body, however we want to define those differences. So unfortunately, English is still really, really bad at this. We don't have a good structure for it. But so, for example, one of the things that I mentioned in the book is this really interesting experience by Dr. Alia Crum, who she took two milkshakes, and one is labeled like luxury milkshake and one is labeled like diet milkshake. And she gives them to the same group of participants, and, you know, they do it, but they monitor their ghrelin, their hunger hormone response, based on what they ate. Now, the shakes are identical. They're just labeled differently. And if you ate the luxury one, your hunger decreased at a much higher rate. Your sense of satiety was increased. Your body responded as if you had consumed more calories, right? The exact opposite effect was found with the diet shake. Your body was still hungry, felt it had not received the calories it wanted. Now, that goes beyond a subjective level of interaction, because there is a physical hormone that has been produced in response to this imaginary distinction, right? This goes even further into sort of placebo, which is, you know, I quote Ramsey Dukes, it's just what we call magical healing now, right? Like, it was always a part of all of our healing. It was always a part of our understanding. We just, for the last 200 years, 300 years, have put it in its own special category. But that's actually an aberration. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because the word placebo has such a negative connotation as well.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's in part because, frankly, it's in part because drug companies don't like the fact that you can often get as big an effect from telling someone you're going to be fine and if you're wearing a white coat as you do giving them your pill, you know. So, like, that's another frustrating element there. So you see these physical changes. So, and you can even get into things like, this is from the hardcore materialist science end of things. This is not my lovely tinfoil hat magician friends. So this information really is from some of the hardcore materialist side of things, but you can now see massive reductions in pain. You can see people learning to cure their colds or cure, like, these sort of immune responses that we thought were only physically triggered can be triggered by giving someone a medicine with a certain flavored drink in it, and then giving them the flavored drink without the medicine. And you'll get the same response as if they had the medicine. So it's it basically says that we are information exchange systems, and that we're getting a lot of different information from different inputs, but that changing those or altering them through an encounter with spirit or dream or whatever has a physical effect on the body. And, you know, the other interesting piece is that of nocebo. So it's not just that we can improve people's outcomes by doing certain things. We can actually cause negative outcomes by implying that they will happen. So there was a great study on lactose intolerance where they actually gave people the symptoms of lactose intolerance who were not previously lactose intolerant with just a sugar pill and telling them what the side effects could be, right? So there's a professional association in Germany of doctors who are now saying, is this malpractice? Like, am I actually inflicting illness on my patients if I'm not taking this very seriously in terms of how I address this with my bedside manner? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, cursing is real. Blessing is real.
Yeah. It gives a whole new meaning to me to those depression medication commercials where they're like, side effects may include suicide.
Right. Well, and, you know, I don't know if you've heard that a really interesting recent thing just happened where they said that the serotonin thesis for depression is incorrect, or at least doesn't have as much validity as previously said. And this is I forget which major medical journal this was in, but it was in one of the top medical journals and was everywhere. And however, there's a really cool thing that happens there, because some people who have taken SSRIs have seen, you know, positive results in terms of managing their depression. What that means is that, yes, the theory can be wrong. Those drugs may not have been helping that person, but their own placebo effect, their own internal strength, has been healing their depression. And, you know, obviously people should talk to their doctors about what they want to do with stuff, but I find that incredibly heartening to tell someone who thought, I will maybe have to be on SSRIs the rest of my life, to be told instead, actually, you were the one who was providing the healing. That to me is, I don't know, that's a great little miracle, I think. But
I think so, too. I think there's a lot of people who would benefit from that knowledge.
Right.
So the next question I wanted to ask, which is kind of tangential to this, do you feel like this work with the Deccans, like, are they implicitly in themselves healers? Or do you maybe have a special connection to, like, say, Ashlepsis, in which that was how they presented themselves and wanted to be presented through you?
It's an interesting question. So the text that I was working with most was the Sacred Book of Hermes to Asclepius. And again, this is sort of coming out of the work we were doing at Rune Soup. And if people are interested in the original binding ritual and what that year-long walk looks like, I encourage them to go to Rune Soup and check it out. I won't get into too many details of how that went down beyond my own experience. But so it was always framed in the context of their healing capacity, right? That's true. However, I think they are rather, they are spirits of time, first and foremost, and of, you know, this kind of like division of the zodiac. So they have their own kind of like lunar mansions or these other things they have, or spirits like that. They have these capacities that exist in the physical because of where they sit in time. Mm-hmm. and their connections to the body. And I actually see them as spirits of illness healing as one capacity. So, right, they govern the parts of the body that respond in these kinds of things. That doesn't mean they're limited to healing, but they have a particular dominion that expresses itself there. The natural inclination is to see that as issues of, again, cursing or blessing, right? Like, we sort of see those kind of like spirits who typically control healing are also spirits who give illness or have some control. That's true. But my guess is there are also additional aspects of our bodily knowing that they are also governing. I'm not particularly sure off the top of my head what that would be, you know what I mean? But there's something about, like, I was just talking with a client actually about Zamendris, who's the first decan of Virgo, who has to deal with, I think that's right. Anyway, deals with governing the belly, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the belly is a larger concept, right? Like it's the cauldron of our being, right? Like it's this thing that, so, you know, would I engage with that decan spirit if I had intestinal difficulties? Like, yeah, I probably would. You know, that seems like a good idea. But I could also talk to them about what does it mean to hold fire, you know, to hold energy in the body. It is connected to my breathing, even if it's not the lungs. It's another part that's doing that. So I think there is probably a wider wisdom that's available. Yeah, because it's about governance rather than like specific doctor spirit. Yeah.
I love that. I love that pointing out that they are time spirits. It immediately implies that they work within matter.
Yeah.
Because time, well, matter is the byproduct of time. So I love that. But also the idea that these aspects of the body can also be like somehow psychological or metaphors for deeper implications. But it also made me think about things like somatic therapy, like right. Body Keeps the Score or Waking the Tiger, in which like the felt sense in my body, like if I have anger and I feel it in a specific part of my body, I could call on that Deccan spirit to help with anger, right. Even though it's not the legs or wherever it is I happen to feel that emotion.
I think this is a really good way to put it. And I think this is a really good observation because that's exactly that. You're taking what I was trying to get to and putting it into much better words. And I appreciate that because this is, it's a really great observation that like, so part of the Tai Chi teaching, our body is our teacher, right? Mm-hmm. The form is a method for learning the harmony, right? The form is not the goal. In the same way, I feel like our hands teach us things about grasping, but that's not, you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of grasping I do that isn't just limited to my hands, but it's the point of investigation, right? Like, and I don't believe this is out of line to share. In that particular client's case, they were talking to me about insomnia and the reading was pointing to issues of the belly, right? And so like, that's not a straightforward one-to-one connection, but once you sit with it a while, it starts to make a lot of sense. You know.
Oh, the churning desire.
All kinds of
and
things.
And that can keep you awake.
right. You know, what is the feet, right? Or, you know, we can connect this back to sort of mugwort and the idea of travel or, you know, dream or getting us where we want to go or what's rooted in our bodies. And, you know, I think these are good investigations into these spirits are good guides for those kind of investigations for sure. I actually wanted to, if you don't mind, circle back a little on something you said about matter being the byproduct of time, which I think is a nice way to put it too. I tend to think of matter as kind of how we categorize or deal with time. Mm-hmm. Like that we just, or energy and time is another way we sort of handle that. But it's this idea that it's how we can start to understand what's happening around us. But it is, I love the idea that it's intrinsically connected to time there because, it's always changing and it's never free from that component of time.
Yeah.
What, for you, where do you locate spirit in that matrix of time and matter and energy? What is that, how in your practice?
So I'm very informed by things like Flatland. Mm-hmm. Have you read that book?
Yeah.
That basically informs like my conception of the dimensional worlds.
Right.
And so, you know, anybody who's familiar with my work knows that I do a lot of work on, you know, HGA stuff, Holy Guardian Angel stuff. And to me, like that is just the spirit of me that transcends out of of these dimensions,
right,
and is like entered itself into dimensions that like my ego tunnel, which is a philosophical conception. Of course, I gave that book away. Thomas Metzinger is the philosopher who writes about the ego tunnel, which is, he's just saying like, we view time and matter through the dimensions that our brain is able to conceive.
Right.
So my spirit, in my HGA as well as other spirits, are things that transcend that ego tunnel. Mm-hmm. So they're either above or beyond time in a way that's hard for us to think about spatially because our brain isn't equipped to think about it spatially. Unless you're on psychedelics.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or, well, I mean, or, you know, and psychedelics are great teachers for this particular thing. It was funny when I started experimenting that way. Part of it was I was like, I recognize this is like my brain normally, only like slightly more so. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it was just like, this is familiar. And apparently that's not the experience everybody has, but that was my experience. And I think it points to sort of something poetry is also doing, right? Like it's also opening that up for you, trying to take time and set it on a different angle. I love the idea that like one of the things about the Deccan spirits is that originally they were tied to specific stars. But obviously as precession happened, because Egypt is very old, they became tied to the parts of the zodiac that they had been observed in rather than the specific stars. And there's something really lovely about how that gives them a place, right? It gives for us to intersect. It gives us a place of meeting them, right? But once you start remembering the world is a globe and that like, I'm not always looking up, I'm looking out, right?
Yes.
Like I'm, you know, up is not where I'm looking on this thing.
Oh, that's very flatland.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah,
not
yeah.
Not north, but up.
Yeah. And you start to realize that like, oh, some of my hierarchies or looking ups or this kind of interactions aren't necessary, right? Or don't actually apply. And it gets really weird really fast, but fun. It gets really fun.
Oh, I love that. Then that makes me think about, so going into your poems now, some of them were extremely typographically important.
Right.
In a way that even I found myself reading them as if they were maps.
Right.
And I was taking a different path every time. And somehow, no matter which way I went, it felt right.
I'm actually very excited and happy you said that. I worked really hard for that to be true.
So that was intentional then.
Yes. Yeah. There are particular ones where it's more successful than others, I think. It's something I do try to embody in writing generally, is to see how different paths of meaning through a poem can change it. But also that, like, as you say, not all the poems are that way. And it's not just a matter of difficulty. Some spirits seem more inclined to want a multiplicity of multiplicity of readings present in their particular work. Maybe I should read one of those to
yes,
sort of
please.
Yeah, because otherwise, if people don't have the book, they're just like, "What are you guys talking about?"
Right.
Let me just find one real quick. Did you have one that you liked that stood out?
So Cancer 2, the very first one in the book, was very striking in that way.
Yeah. And so Cancer 2, which I'll happily read here, is intended to be effectively read across. You can read it across like a normal structure that you would do for a poem, or you can read it in three columns. There's probably other ways to read it too. Once you sort of crack that, mm-hmm. you know, and if people find compelling other ways to do it, congratulations, you win extra. You know what I mean? You've outdone me, you know? But yeah, so I'll just read this one then. Cancer 2, Somakal Mice, Lungs. Do you dare linger with me the night, bear the waiting, fingertip to lip, let silence like a walled garden keep, absent within reach, hopes, and thrum deep within our edging crepe myrtle skin, desire to abandon all, escape to my arms. Do you dare come gliding, great blue, biding thunder in its wake, to the wonder of a mirrored lake that holds tight but never takes the stars? And then, if you were to read, say, the first one vertically, do you dare bear the waiting like a walled garden? Hopes are edging to abandon all escape, come gliding in its wake that holds tight. Although I feel like the middle there, or the last one there, is the one that gets me the most, which is the night, let silence absent within reach, deep within desire. Do you dare thunder a mirrored lake and take the stars?
Ugh, so moving.
Thank you.
Well, there were definitely some of these poems that made me cry.
I'm sorry to say that makes me very happy, but
well, of ecstasy, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it, because it wasn't joy or
right.
pain. It was just, I felt that, you know.
Yeah.
So it was is very clear. Not only are you a skilled poet, but that these entities really were speaking through you.
Yes, and. It's I'm glad you said it that way, because this is something that feels true to me in that in the first writing of these poems, I often didn't know the reference points.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were usually built out of some understanding of what happened to me in that particular time frame to, you know, sort of to build a kind of talismanic place for the poems to exist. But what I found, speaking of time spirits, is that many of these poems ended up describing personal experiences I would have 2 years later from the writing. And so I would only in the editing realize that the thing it was describing had just happened to me the week before. And yeah, it was very, very humbling to realize that these time spirits, you know, there's a point when you're writing poems, you're like, I wrote a good poem. Look at me. I'm really smart. And then to have the actual event I described almost word for word manifest in my life was like, no, we were showing you what was coming so that you could understand what you needed to put in. And yeah, so it's very humbling for me as well to read the poems.
I also love that kind of demonstrates what we were talking about earlier, like where do spirits reside, and talking about Flatland, is even though they are time spirits who govern time and maybe govern matter, they do seem to be outside of time looking down or looking in.
Yes.
So that in that way they can see, you know, there is no linear time to them. And so they can say, yeah, 2 years from now, this is going to happen. In their mind, it's not even 2 years from now. It's probably happening simultaneously with the moment you are experiencing.
Yeah, they definitely feel that way. And in fact, the first one I worked a healing with, Thursuis, was very clear that he was angry that I had not contacted him to heal something in my past. And I was like, sorry, bro. Like, I didn't know you, you know? And he's like, why would that matter? Why does that matter? You know?
Yeah, well, that raises up its own paradox that I've tangentially been trying to learn more about, but I'm no quantum mechanic scientist.
No, my degree's in poetry, not in physics. Yeah.
But I have heard people, like scientists in the cog-sci realm and quantum mechanics realm, are pushing this idea that it's possible for the future to affect the past.
Yes. Which I think is true. I don't, it's one of those things where you hear it and I'm like, that feels true. I'm not sure if I can explain exactly why, but there's something about it that resonates. Although, so I don't do a lot of retrospective magic, although I do know people who do. And you know, one of the, I think one of the easier ways we can think about that is perhaps in terms of memory. So mm-hmm. one of the things that's difficult with traumatic memory is that it gets locked in place. Most memory changes in the telling, right? Over time, memory grows with us to help us better understand our present. It doesn't, memory isn't necessarily about preserving the past. It's about preserving our future, right? It's supposed to help us get to a future. And one of the problems with traumatic memory is that it never changes and gets locked. And so there's some very good success with even just straight up CBT kind of approaches of having people tell their story slightly differently to mm-hmm. alter the memory or to change their understanding of it so that it has a different kind of effect in their lives. But if I can change my memory of an event so that it affects healing in my present and produces a better future, that is literally my present, which is the future for my past event, influencing it, right? You know, and people can fuss about whether or not that thing actually happened, but there may be some hard limits. You know what I mean? There may be some things that are kind of stuck in place that are big enough that I think I'm actually literally just doing quantum leap right now, that there's some things you can't change. But like, I think that we do understand that if we have a different perspective, even on a memory, it can alter our entire present and our future life. And so that's where I start with the past. The future influences the past, but yeah.
I love that because you came at that question from the perspective of a poet as opposed to a scientist, and you gave me just as satisfying of an answer, I think.
Oh, good.
So with that being said, I think that does kind of feed well into my next question. We talked about some of your poems, the typography maybe looking like maps.
Yeah.
There were others that looked like a pictograph.
Yes.
And in that is very much you're asking the reader to be emotionally drawn to both the words and the pictograph. The reader themselves, every reader will have a different emotional response to that pictograph because our memory or our conception of what that image represents is going to be different for each person.
Right. No, I was just going to say, and the shapes are tend to be, because they're not drawn. I mean, the art is amazing. If you want to look at the art, Brennan has provided great art. But in terms of the shape of the poem, it's meant to be somewhat abstract in that, like, you know, my guess is you're going to apply sometimes even a different image to that than I would have applied.
And that in and of itself is you giving the reader agency to heal where they need to be healed.
I firmly think that the idea that, you know, I believe that the writer is a participant in the work. I don't think that, you know, the author has nothing to say about their own work or their intention doesn't matter, but I think it is only a piece of what matters, you know, and in the reader's response is incredibly important, and there always has to be room for them to have their own experience if it's going to be real. You know, again, I think actually most people have encountered really bad poetry that tries to define every aspect of how this is supposed to be read and excludes the reader from it. And then the poet is like, why doesn't anybody like this? And you're like, well, you didn't invite anybody else to the party.
You tried too hard.
Yeah. You squeezed it out. You know what I mean? Like, you squeezed them out of it. And yeah, it's funny, you know, there are some poems that, you know, Leo One wanted to be in a triangle, downward facing triangle, to make a reference to the protection charms of like the Calamaris or this kind of, you know, different shapes. But some of them, you know, Gordon was teasing me that, and Jen actually at Revelor, my wonderful editor and the publisher there, who's amazing, was teasing me that, you know, one of them is just very clearly the butt plug poem. And I'm like, thanks. You know?
You know, if that's what it wanted to be, that's fine.
That's what it wanted to be. We all need healing and ecstasy in our own ways. I have no objection to that particular interpretation. But I don't think everybody seeing that's going to see that particular manifestation.
I gotta say, I read the whole thing, and I don't know which poem she's talking about.
So that's just something Jen and I share, and I guess we understand these images in the same way. But yeah, and I was actually really encouraged in this by my friend, the poet M.R.B. Chelko, who was pointing out that the form we think of poetry taking, the sort of stanzas in a row, everything else, is a construction of a sort of Renaissance understanding of how syllables should be contained. It's something that isn't intrinsic to poetry. And for a long time, I think concrete poetry and the idea that, like, if you write a poem about a tree, it should be in a shape of a tree. Like, that is sort of annoying. You know, I get that. But it's something else we can use. It's another tool that things like music can't do in terms of what's on the page, but it does do it in terms of silence in the space, right?
Yes.
And so if all we have is the page to make silence, we have to try to find that where we can. So,
yeah. Oh, beautiful. So you mentioned Brennan. I haven't asked any questions about them yet. Between the two of you, was it very much like Crowley and Lady Frida, where you're like dictating how they need to look, or was Brennan doing their own ecstatic trance and then showing you the picture, and you were like, oh my god, it's exactly how I saw it in my head?
I love the Crowley Lady Frida connection, because I went through a whole Crowley phase where I read everything Crowley wrote. I read all of it. And I concluded at the end that he's a giant asshole that most people don't need to read about. Like, honestly, if you want to read Dion Fortune, you'll get 90% of what Crowley's talking about. And then you can just throw on some of the other OTO stuff. But like, it's, he's a funny old bastard. And, I really think that Thoth deck, which is a powerful deck, but like, is so much her. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I know he's got his symbols all over it and everything else, but at the end of the day, the paintings are just like, good luck, buddy. You know what I mean? Like good.
It is her who makes that deck. Yeah. 100%.
It's the same thing with the weight decks too, where you're like, you see what he wrote and then you see what's on the page and you're like, well, it's nice that your scryer actually decided to do the real work here. You know,
yeah.
Something amazing. No, Brennan and I actually worked mostly separately. And Brennan's understanding of these is not mine exactly. I did provide in the beginning, I would write out some research elements to try to give thought, you know, sort of, I think it's important for writers working with artists to try to help feed them, right? Like just to say, this is all I have. This is where you can go. But Brennan was often working, at least in the initial sketches, because he also did it in the time periods where the poem wasn't finished. So he's having his own deckhand experience in the time frame that is manifest in his woodcuts that show up in the space. It was interesting because the spirits were very clear. So one of the other things I did a lot of in this process was divination, because is this what you want? Is this good? Are we done editing this poem? You know, like, can we walk away now? Sometimes that's clear, sometimes it wasn't. And so I would just rely on divination for that. And the spirits were very clear from early on that they wanted Brennan to do it. And they wanted to see that combination of energies. And that's how they wanted to manifest. So
that's something special about y'all's relationship then.
Yeah. And I think I like actually this idea of a community producing art rather than a single vision dictating it. You know, I think that, again, the idea of the auteur that controls everything, I think is done, or at least should be. Yeah.
Especially when we're writing about magic and animism and spirit work.
They don't have a unified perspective. So, you know, why would we? Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. So this is actually something I meant to ask earlier. Do you, or when you were writing these poems, did you do a official invocation? I know you said you didn't want to talk about the first year and the work that was done through the Rune Soup group, but the next 2 years,
right.
Was there a formal invocation, or were you mentioned some like just walking through the world during that time period may in and of itself created the sacred space. So
I won't give the details of the first year. What I will say is that that was an official process of like binding. You know what I mean? It would look more similar to any other kind of like, it's not a grimoire exercise, but it would look like that. There are invocations, there are binding commands and, you know, things like that. The next year, what it actually was once we entered the Deccan, I would sort of refresh my understanding by sort of just looking over the ritual again. I didn't actually perform it each time, but I would call the spirit up in this sort of like, in the way that once you have made connection with a spirit, you can then just call them up, right? Like, yes. You don't have to do the whole ritual every time. And then I would sort of just ask them basically to participate in the writing of the poem and to tell me what they needed and then work from there. And it was kind of a crazy time period. I mean, I had a lot of really strange experiences. One of the poems is based on an actual experience I had where I was walking through the quad of a college and suddenly relived a moment where I almost drowned. And it felt like being a magician in the tank, looking out at everybody else, like I'm drowning for real and no one else is noticing that I'm stuck in water because they can't see this spirit tank that I'm now trapped in. And like, I went through the whole process of even like laying on the ground, gasping after, I don't know what people were thinking when they said
maybe they were thinking you were struggling from your finals or a test or something.
I will tell you that one of the best things you can ever do is if someone says, what are you doing with magic? You can just tell them as an invisibility spell, this is for an art project. And people will backpedal and run away as fast as possible. You're like, this is my situational art thesis. They're like, oh, nope, it's good. Whatever you're doing, it's fine. It's fine. I don't want to know anymore.
Oh, I love that tip.
Yeah. But so I think what happened was the spirits, by inviting them in the beginning of the Deccan to participate, they participated. So they would provide whatever motivation or dreams or physical experiences I needed in order to get the poem done. And then that process repeated itself during the editing, where it was now, you know, impinging on me, like, you need to fix this. It was actually more pressure in the third year.
I love that the spirits like respect the writing process. Like, oh, you have to get all the information out on the page and we're so proud of you. And then a year later, it's like, now get rid of the stuff we don't want.
It was part of the deal. You know, I set out with them when I was doing this. I will do this a 3-year process, but I'm going to need time. And they were like, that's fine, but you're going to do it in our timing. You know what I mean? Like, it's always a negotiation.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, this was my last question. So when you were writing these poems, did you find that there was a easier connection or like a closer relationship to Deccans that were prominent in your birth chart?
Ooh, that's really interesting. I went through, so one of the texts I did use when trying to find more information and make sure I was gathering stuff was 36 Faces by Austin Coppock. And, you know, I presume I will at some point, presuming he never actually brings out the new one, I'll just use my, my copy for my retirement income at some point. Like
that. One day I'll be able to secondhand buy that book from someone.
Oh my God. I got lucky and I got it at the original price. And I looked 2 weeks later and I was like, it's a plane ticket to Europe now. Great. Yep. But going into that, the idea, so looking at my chart and just seeing like what is prominent and where does it stand out? I basically have no decanal gifts. Like, I mean, there's obviously stuff in the chart that lights up, but, I don't have any, you know, there's none of those dignities where I was like, man, I have a great placement here. You know what I mean? Like, things are awesome. And So what I found actually is that much like getting to know the wheel of the year through the zodiac, like when you start to sort of, and again, I'm actually a really bad astrologer. I learned geomancy so I wouldn't have to do astrology, and then found out that geomancy's like language is like 80% astrology. So I had to learn astrology in order to understand geomancy, which was a real pain in the ass.
To be fair, tarot can be a lot like that too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but what I have found over time is that engaging with the wild relationships that exist in the birth chart, right? That through the whole course of the year and your transits and everything that's happening, it makes every part of your chart suddenly come alive. Mm. That even these sections of rest or quiet in your chart are now bound into a seasonal understanding of the power of quiet, right? And that's what I found with the decans too, is that instead of discovering that I had a particular affinity for one or the other, I discovered that all of them were present in my body and in my chart, and they all had something to say to me. And I take a seasonally devotional approach now, in the same way of like I actually happen to love winter and I love summer and I want both. And,
oh, I love that. I love that basically you're touching on this fact that there is no such thing as an empty house or an empty right. placement. My wonderful Hellenistic astrologer friend, Delana, who hosts the Moon Matters podcast, is on this stickler of calling them open houses.
Ooh,
because
that's great.
She hates that word empty because of the connotation there.
Well, and to be fair, I had learned some of this. Jess, who I mentioned earlier, she and I wrote a small sort of zine series of haiku back and forth to the lunar mansions. And so where we would both sort of engage with them and then bring the haiku, and then we would provide a kind of joint or shared haiku into the so they communicated with each other into the poem.
Oh my gosh, did you know that they used to have in Japan haiku battles?
Like- yes. Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. The Renga format is actually something I wish more people would play with. Particularly, I think it is a particularly great, epistolary or letter format. Like if you're missing your friend, writing a haiku back and forth to each other via email and just beautiful. Trading the verses, fantastic. Like really worth your time. But in that process of going through the nakshatra connections, the lunar mansions, you saw the same thing happening. And because it's quicker, you kind of get it a little faster where you're like, oh, this energy is always present in this day and is there for me to understand. So I think that that experience with Jess was a real guide into understanding how the Deccan stuff worked as well over time. Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah, I definitely noticed when I was reading it that there wasn't very much a correlation between the ones that moved me the most and at least what I could obviously see big things happening in my birth chart. I mean, I thought it was interesting. For example, I have a Deccan 3 Leo Chiron.
Okay.
And I did cry in that poem. And I was like, maybe this is because Chiron as the healer, like that's why this one in particular moved me. But then, you know, I have an open house in Virgo.
Right.
And Virgo 3 also brought me to tears. So
right.
It didn't, the scientist in me wanted it to work, but it did not work like that.
Well, and then I wonder if perhaps when we're moved that way, you know, if the parts of our body, either in the larger metaphor of the body or in the actual just straight up physical piece, needed something from that encounter. Like they need, you know, and so there was more, it's the thing of like where there's a lack, there's more of a response, you know, like maybe yes. there was an imbalance or something that needed to be brought forward or a strength you got to recognize, you know?
Oh, like, I didn't even think about that, but that's very wise. Yeah.
I'm glad it sounded wise.
Well, because I was just like, why Virgo 3? Why Virgo? And
right.
and now it's like, well, yeah, actually, like I know about how the, you know, somatic body works.
Right.
And so it would make perfect sense, like, for whatever was going on with me at that time, maybe corresponded with the Virgo 3 body part.
Right.
And that was why it was moving.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to leap and say that that is what's happening, just for the sake of the next thing, just to say that I do think that's kind of how some of the healing works in this thing too, is that yes, you can do it for specific ailments. You can sit down and create your own sort of Wheel of the Year talisman as a general protection for yourself. You can do all these things, but that sort of listening you're talking about with the somatic understanding of the body and saying, oh, I read this poem and it moved me, can be an introduction to, can be a healing of its own, just to call it to mindfulness and to heal it, but then also can be an introduction to, oh, let me sit with this some more and let me see what else I could, what other strengths I could gain here that move through me. So, yeah, you discovered a great method.
Well, I like this idea of using it for the emotional healing as well as the bodily healing. I think that was a good thing to touch on.
Yeah, I don't think they're different. It's just an access point, right? My Tai Chi teacher, when I was first learning from him, I came from a bunch of different martial arts trainings and I had a whole bunch of, you know, background. And so he wanted to show me an application in Tai Chi and he said, put your hand on my chest. I said, cool. And he was like, no, I didn't say push me. I said, put your hand on my chest. And I was like, I'm not pushing you, old man. Like I'm just putting my hand on my chest. And he's like, no, it's my chest. You're pushing me, you know? And I had a complete weeping, go sit in the corner for a while breakdown because I was pushing him and I was pushing a whole lot of things away in my life at that point. I was trying to keep everything pushed away. And he was very wise and came over to me and said, like, this happens when you engage with the body and the healing of the body, the emotions come out. When you engage with the emotions and heal those, the body changes, right? He's like, this is true. He's like, there are going to be times where I'm going to need to know your emotional state to get you down into a stance, right? To increase your flexibility, I'm going to have to change your emotional state. He's like, now, this is all good and valid, but can we please go back so I can show you that application I wanted to show you now? And I've seen that with my own students. It's very true.
So I personally don't have a background in Tai Chi, but I have a background in yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have my, you know, YTT, whatever. I've never taught it, but I did go to India and I learned it there. And there were some poses that they would bring up, like, do this pose if you're trying to forgive somebody.
Right.
Or do this pose if you're trying to, like, let go of something that's holding you back. And I definitely, like, of all the things that I learned at my ashram, like, that is the main thing that I keep with me, is, like, when I'm super angry and I'm mad at somebody and I'll just get down and do the frog pose.
Right.
It's all here in my hips. Get out of my hips.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, and I think that if we had a better understanding of things, the prescriptions would make more sense. I mean, and like that, we would have more of those. And, yes. You know, one of the things I talk about in the introduction is that the priests, the temple of the Asclepion, they would say, engage with this spirit, do this kind of art, chant this kind of poem, you know, go on this pilgrimage, right? Like, yeah. You know, and I think those are just essential parts of healing that in current contemporary Western culture we have neglected, but that has always been our birthright and is always something we should engage with. There's a poet, Donald Hall, who wrote a book called Without after the death of his partner. And my father, who used to do some pastoral care work, would give this book to widowers who could not grieve, and it would crack them open, you know? And that's what this should do. You know what I mean? Like, this is, it's important that that art be magic, that it be pushing the edges and changing things. You know, we have enough simple records of things. What we need is this stuff that will help us.
Yeah. And what is the point of magic if not to change things?
Yep. Secret of magic is simple. You can change your life.
Yep. Oh, yep. Love that. All right. Well, so normally I end the podcast by just saying anything that you want to say or share with the audience. This is your like open-ended invitation to say whatever you want to say.
The only thing I really want to say is sort of taking off from where we just said that you can change your life, that there, whether through this book and these spirits, which I hope people will engage with for their healing, I want that introduction for people, or through yoga, or through body work, or through meditation, or through listening, through healing intentions, through Reiki. I want people to understand that this healing is present and available, and that they can do this, and that it is both, and I understand there are issues of continuous pain, there are issues of disability, there are issues of hardship that people face that are real. This is also real for you. This stuff can make your life better immediately. It will help you. So, you know, there's a lot of outside pressure trying to say that this doesn't work, that this isn't for you, that only one mode of healing is available. I think it's a multiplicity. I think that your allopathic doctor will heal you the best they can. And I think they need good help from magical healing. And I think your shaman will heal you as best they can. But occasionally it's good to get a splint on your leg too. And so, you know, I just want to encourage people to affect their own healing as much as possible, and to believe that they can, because from what I can tell, it's absolutely true. Oof.
The first step to magic is believing.
Yeah.
Step one, you got to believe.
Just, if nothing else, to dream, to take the chance, you know, try to build a bridge without dreaming about it first. It's not going to work. So imagine better. Yeah.
I like that you brought up that it's an interdependence between the homeopathic and the allopathic.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think both sides probably do healing. They don't understand why it works exactly the way it works. And I think, you know, both have some really great technologies to offer. And that's sort of the point of the introduction, is that, you know, what we have now is a spectrum that continues from an ancient tradition that involved all of these elements. And while I do think it's time to move past a simple materialist model, that doesn't mean that, you know, your local doctor can't also help you. I think it's just a matter of putting things in the right framework and the right balance points. And, you know, again, in some ways, talking about, as you were talking about reading the poems, that there are many ways into a healing, and that it's worth investigating whatever is happening. On that, I would also just recommend, there's another magician who writes very eloquently about this, Ivy Bromius, over at circlethrice.com. She wrote a fantastic book that's available for free called The Cancer Grimoire, about her own process healing and surviving cancer, and which she offers to people as a way of saying, this is helpful. But she goes into the herbal roots of chemotherapy to better understand, you know, how the plants are helping you even in that structure. And it's a brilliant book, and I would highly recommend people check Ivy out if they're interested in this topic at all.
Wonderful. I already have some friends I'd like to send that book to.
I have actually done the same. Here's a Deccan spirit, and also here's Ivy's book. Please read it.
Best of both worlds.
Yep.
Well, all right. Thank you so much, Brian. This was such a joy and a treat. I enjoyed every moment.
Thank you. I it was great to get to talk to you, and I very much appreciated your perspective you brought to the poems. It showed me some things I hadn't thought of, so I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Oh, that's so sweet.